რადიო თავისუფლება FM 107.4
ეთერშია ახალი ამბების გამოშვება. ბარაკ ობამა მოლაპარაკებას გამართავს ისლამური სახელმწიფო საწინააღმდეგო სტრატეგიაზე. ბათუმის სპორტში 5-დღიანი ვიზიტით იმყოფება ამერიკული სამხედრო ხომალდი Mount Whitney. 3 სექტემბრის შემდეგ საჯაროდ პირველად გამოჩნდა ჩრდილოეთ კორეის ლიდერი. შეერთებული შტატების პრეზიდენტი ბარაკ ობამა 14 ოქტომბერს 20 ქვეყნის სამხედრო ლიდერებს შეხვდება და განიხილავს ისლამური სახელმწიფოს ექსტრემისტების საწინააღმდეგო სტრატეგიას სირიასა და ერაყში. შეხვედრებს, რომლებიც ვაშინგტონის გარეთ ენდრიუსის საჰაერო ბაზაზე გამართება მთელი დღის განმავლობაში, უხელმძღვანელებს შეერთებული შტატების გაერთიანებული შტაბის უფროსი გენერალი მარტინ დემპსი. შეხვედრების ფონია შეერთებული შტატების ხელმძღვანელობით მოქმედ კოალიციაზე განხორციელებული ზეწოლა შეაჩეროს ექსტრემისტული ჯგუფის შეტევა, რომელმაც ბოლო ხანებში წინ წაიწია ერაყის დასავლეთში მდებარე ანბარის პროვინციასა და სირიის ქალაქ კობანიში, რომელიც თურქეთის საზღვართან მდებარეობს. გავრცელებული ცნობებით, დღევანდელ შეხვედრაში მონაწილე ქვეყნებს შორის თურქეთიც იქნება, ისევე როგორც ის არაბული ქვეყნები, მაგალითად საუდის არაბეთი და არაბეთის გაერთიანებული საამიროები, რომლებიც შეუერთდნენ სირიაში ექსტრემისტების წინააღმდეგ შეერთებული შტატების ხელმძღვანელობით მიმდინარე საჰაერო კამპანიას. ბათუმის პორტში 5-დღიანი ვიზიტით იმყოფება ამერიკული სამხედრო ხომალდი Mount Whitney. მისი ეკიპაჟის წევრებთან ერთად დაგეგმილია ანტიტერორისტული და ხანძარ საწინააღმდეგო წვრთნები, რომლებშიც მონაწილეობას მიიღებენ საქართველოს სანაპირო დაცვის სამსახურის და ქალაქ ბათუმის სამაშველო და სახანძრო სამსახურების თანამშრომლები. სამხედრო გემის ეკიპაჟის წევრებს შორისაა შეერთებული შტატების სამხედრო საზღვაო ძალების ლეიტენანტი, თბილისში დაბადებული გივი ტიბანელი. 29 წლის ოფიცერმა ჟურნალისტებს უამბო, რომ საქართველოდან 10 წლის ასაკში გაემგზავრა და მას შემდეგ სან-ფრანცისკოში ცხოვრობდა. შეერთებული შტატების საელჩოს მიერ გავრცელებულ პრეს-რელიზში ნათქვამია, რომ Mount Whitney-ის ვიზიტი ადასტურებს ვაშინგტონის ძალისხმევას გააღრმავოს ურთიერთობა ნატოელ მოკავშირეებსა და საქართველოს მსგავს პარტნიორებთან შავი ზღვის რეგიონში მშვიდობისა და სტაბილურობის გამტკიცებისთვის. ჩრდილოეთ კორეის ოფიციალურ გამოცემაში როდონგ სიმუნში 14 ოქტომბერს დაიბეჭდა ქვეყნის ლიდერის კიმ ჩენ ინის რამდენიმე ფოტო, რომლებზეც ის თითქოს ყავარჯვნითაა აღბეჭდილი. 40 დღეზე მეტი დროის განმავლობაში სახელმწიფო მედია პირველად არცოლებს ცნობას ლიდერის საჯაროდ გამოჩენის შესახებ. ფოტოსერიაში მომღიმარე კიმ ჩენ ინი ესრება ახლა დაშენებული საცხოვრებელი სახლების გახსნის ცერემონიას. 31 წლის ლიდერის საჯაროსფეროდან დიდი ხნით გაქრობამ ბიძგი მისცა ვარაუდებს მისი ჯანმრთელობის მდგომარეობის შესახებ. შეკითხვები დაისვა ასევე მის რეალურ ძალაუფლებაზე ამ ტოტალიტარულ კომუნისტურ სახელმწიფოში. გასული თვის ბოლოს ნაჩვენებ ოფიციალურ დოკუმენტურ ფილმში ითქვა, რომ ლიდერს დისკომფორტი აწუხებს. ჩრდილოეთ კორეის ხელმძღვანელობასთან დაახლოებულმა წყარომ 10 ოქტომბერს განაცხადა, რომ ის მტკიცე დაკონტროლებს თავის მთავრობას. საჯაროსფეროდან დროებით გაქრობა კი იმით იყო გამოწვეული, რომ მან სამხედრო წვრთნაში მონაწილეობისას ფეხი იტკინა. ავტორიტეტიანი უფლებადამცველი ორგანიზაცია Amnesty International-ი ახალ ანგარიშში ამბობს, რომ ერაყში მოქმედმა შიიტთა გასამხედროებულმა ჯგუფებმა ბოლო თვეებში გაიტაცეს და დახოცეს ბევრი სუნიტი მუსლიმი სამოქალაქო პირი და ისინი სრული დაუშვებლობით სარგებლობენ ამ ომის დანაშაულთა გამო. ანგარიშში, რომელიც 14 ოქტომბერს გამოქვეყნდა და რომელსაც ეწოდება აბსოლუტური დაუშვებლობა გასამხედროებული ჯგუფების მართლობა ერაყში, ეყრდნობა აგვისტოსა და სექტემბერში ჩატარებულ ინტერვიუებს. ანგარიშში დეტალურადაა აღწერილი გასამხედროებული ჯგუფების თავდასხმები ბაღდადში, სამარასა და ქირქუქში. ამ ლონდონში განთავსებული უფლებადამცველი ორგანიზაციის განცხადებით, ნაპოვნია ბევრი ამოუცნობი გვამი, რომელთაგან ბევრს ხელბორკილი ედო და თავში ჰქონდა ნასრული, რაც საჩვენს ვარაუდს, რომ ისინი სიკვდილით დასაჯეს. ამნესტის ცნობით, დაკარგულთაგან ბევრი ჯერაც არაა ნაპოვნი. Amnesty International-ი მიიჩნევს, რომ ეს მკვლელობები სავარაუდოდ წარმოადგენს სამაგიეროს ისლამური სახელმწიფოს ექსტრემისტების მიერ განხორციელებულ თავდასხმებზე. ამასთან ორგანიზაცია წერს, რომ შიიტთა გასამხედროებულ ჯგუფებს, რომელთა ძალაუფლება სულ უფრო იზრდება, ერაყის მთავრობა უჭერს მხარს და იარაღითაც ამარაგებს. რუსეთის საპრეზიდენტო უფლებადამცველი საბჭოს ხელმძღვანელი აცხადებს, რომ ვერ ხედავს მიზეს, რატომ უნდა დაიხუროს დამოუკიდებელი უფლებადამცველი ორგანიზაცია მემორიალი. მიხეილ ფედოტოვმა სააგენტო ინტერფაქსს 13 ოქტომბერს უთხრა, რომ საამისო საფუძველი არ არსებობს. მემორიალის დახურვის თხოვნით რუსეთის იუსტიციის სამინისტრომ 10 ოქტომბერს მიმართა უზენაეს სასამართლოს, თუმცა მიზეზები საჯაროდ არ გამოცხადებულა. მემორიალი შეიქმნა გვიანდელ 80-იან წლებში საბჭოთა პერიოდის დისიდენტების, მათ შორის ანდრეი სახაროვის მიერ. ლაპარაკობს რადიო თავისუფლება.
Welcome to Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. I'm Catherine Cole in Washington, D.C. So pleased that Eliza Gilkison has found her way from Austin, Texas to the Roots studio today. You might remember Eliza from her visit with us 5 years ago. I think she was with us 10 years ago, too. And like Curtis McMurtry, who was here last week, Eliza is also a second-generation songwriter, but I'll let her tell us about her famous father in just a couple of minutes. Play us a song, please. Something from the new CD, The Nocturne Diaries.
Moonlight over the mountain. The sky is midnight blue. I'm thinking about the hard times. Just what was lost in our spiral down from grace. We'll never know the final cost for the worthless dreams we chased. But save your sorrow for another morn. Though your heart lies on the ground, come tomorrow, maybe a new.
To welcome back Eliza Gilkison after far, far, far too many years.
It has been way too long. I don't know how that happened, but I'm so glad to be back.
With a new record, too. This one is called The Nocturne Diaries.
Yes.
And what's the name of that song?
That is called Midnight Oil.
There's sort of some optimism in that one.
God forbid.
Because as much as I love you, you're not always the most optimistic of songwriters.
No, I am a sort of, I am a kind of realist, you know. Mm-hmm. I pay attention to, you know, the facts.
Yes.
But I think somehow I've come to a place of understanding that we can't know what these big changes that are coming and the way we live and the planetary changes, the environmental changes, the economic changes, all the things that we're going to have to face in the years to come. I've been sort of down about it, but then in that song I think I realized that that it's okay to let something go and let something die before something new comes along. And I don't think that we're going to be able to climb out of the situation we've found ourselves in just with an unsustainable, the way we live is unsustainable. The systems that we live in are unsustainable. So my way of thinking, they are going to have to shift, and it may be frightening, but we have to keep our eye on the prize, which is another way of doing things, another way of relating.
And rebirth is a good thing.
It's painful, but it's a good thing.
We'll talk about it a little bit later, but you actually do poke fun at yourself in one of the songs on this record.
It's not that hard to do because I'm actually a pretty joyful person. But
yes, you are.
When I write, I have to say I do. I am at an age and a point in my life where I don't have much angst, really. I'm not. My life is good, so. Mm-hmm. I think when I look around at the world and I see that other people's lives aren't so good, then I think, what are the systems that create this sense of unfairness and inequality? And so that's what I look at. And so I do write about those things, and sometimes it's sad, you know, because there's a lot of suffering around it. And a lot of that can be directly related to the way we live. So that is in my music, but there is that joy under there, and also the sense of that there's still so much wonder and beauty around us in this world and in our lives, so that's a good idea to mark those things too.
Gee, you sound like a folk singer.
Well put. I am a folk singer. People ask me, you know, are you Americana? Are you alt country or something? I'm like, no, I am a folk singer. Those are my roots, and I'm proud of it. There's a great history of socio-political commentary in folk music, so I'm very comfortable with that moniker.
Well, for everyone who has not been with us the other times you visited, I think we need to go back in time a little bit and fill in the blanks. You really have been doing this almost ever since you could walk and talk, haven't you?
That is true. My dad was a folk singer, and so I very early on, I figured out that I recognized that there was a zone, a kind of a magical zone around making music that my dad had really tapped into. And so I loved his friends. I loved the scene. And I knew very early on that this is what I wanted to pursue. And I was a very angst-driven teenager, so it was a very wonderful outlet for me to sing sad songs about myself.
Which is, can you think of a better thing for a teenager, really?
Good point. That's a really good point, because it's a great way to channel your angst. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Yeah. And when you're a teenager, there really isn't much else in the world except yourself, really. I mean, the world does
revolve around you. It does.
So were you one of those kids that would storm up the stairs to your bedroom and pull out your guitar and start writing?
I didn't storm. I slid.
Okay.
I was sort of an invisible, sort of ghostly presence. I had not grounded in myself. I think I had a lot of things to work through. And I think I reinvented myself as a young person when I found music. I found a way to express myself, a kind of a persona I could step into. Years later in therapy, I had to dismantle that girl, but she served me well through the hard, you know, adolescent years.
So you invented this character.
I did. She was very outgoing songwriter, confident, expressive, you know, and meanwhile, I was very shy. I think insecure person underneath there.
Probably like most teenagers.
That's
right?
Isn't that true?
I mean, you wouldn't believe the number of people who come through here who said, oh yeah, when I was growing up as a kid, I was really shy and not outgoing at all. And, you know, I was one of those kids too. My parents put me in a drama class because I was so painfully shy.
Oh my God.
Hated to pick up the phone to call the theater to ask when the show was.
So did you create a persona?
Yeah, of course.
You stepped in?
Sure. You picked a role.
It's
that
way
was
up.
The great thing about acting, you know. But you grew up in California, in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Was there a big music scene that you followed?
Because
of your father,
but,
right?
You know, I missed out on the big folk, because the East Coast really was the folk scene in the 50s and 60s. It was much, I think I would have benefited from having lived in the East, because in the West, we really didn't have, I think Joan Baez was living in California, but that big New York village folk scene really went right past me, and I was too young for it anyway, so I wasn't part of it. So I was tuned into my dad's career, but then when the 60s breakout thing happened in Southern California, then I was all over that, you know. So I really kind of jumped in right about when folk rock was starting to come up.
I guess at the time, you know, your father was having success, and it must have been difficult for him with his success to be accepted as a folk musician.
Well, that is so true. He was absolutely thought of as a sellout because he had hits, and they were pop hits.
Do you want to tell people some of the hits that he wrote?
My dad wrote, well, let's say starting from 1949, Cry of the Wild Goose with Frankie Lane and Tell Me a Story with Doris Day. Mahalia Jackson recorded one of his hymns. And then in the 50s, he had, with his band, the Easy Riders, All Day, All Night, Marianne. Then Dean Martin recorded Memories Are Made of This. Harry Belafonte recorded one of his songs, Little Richard, Johnny Cash. So it went on and on, right up to just a few years ago, the White Stripes recorded one of his very old songs that had been sung by Marlene Dietrich. Mm-hmm. Look Me Over Closely.
So here he was, writing popular songs that became hits, but he wanted to be a folk singer, or was a folk singer.
He had read all of the Alan Lomax books, and he was a big fan of folk music, and that really was his style when he was sitting around picking. But I think it has been said that he was the guy that really crossed folk music into pop music. Because when you look at Frankie Lane doing, who had done Rawhide and The Cry of the Wild Goose, those were folk songs that they had done in a pop style. And when you listen to them now, they're really quite amusing. The strings and the horns, but they were what you would call folk pop. And so I think my pop was very much responsible for bringing folk into the pop world. And he was not beloved of the folk purists, I should say. He actually, in 1950, because he was on Columbia the same time that the Weavers were, they had just signed the Weavers, and my dad had already had a number of hits, and the head of Columbia Records wanted to put the Weavers with my dad because they hadn't had any hits, and then the Weavers didn't want to do it, and neither did my dad, but they went in the studio and they cut On Top of Old Smokey with my dad singing. It's Terry Gilkison and the Weavers, and you can hear Pete and all the Weavers in the background, On Top of Old Smokey, and it was went to number one. So it was their first, it really was their first hit, but they left on not the greatest terms, and Pete and I had a big laugh about it many years later when we finally met.
I can see how a purist might say, oh, that's a selling out.
They did, absolutely. The same ones who booed Bob Dylan when he went rock. There was a real need for it to be its own little island. And I can understand that. But it is really not natural for music to stay. It morphs all the time. That's what music does.
So when you decided that you were interested in playing music, you really had a realistic outlook on how things worked because you'd seen it.
I was also under great illusions that my dad's success could just put me right where I wanted to be, which was not the case because by the time I was old enough to actually do my thing, he was way on the outs. So he didn't have the contact. So I really had to figure out my own way with all of it. I had a wonderful roots base because of him, but there were certainly, no shortcuts were able to be taken.
Well, if anything, you had to be better, maybe because people would look at your name and say, her dad's pretty good. She's got to be
But good. They didn't hear the hit, I tell you.
You're right, right. And they'd expect it.
They would have expected something a little more hit-oriented, and I was not. I really was self-confessional, angst-ridden, and very internalized music. So I wasn't thinking the way he was. My dad was. My dad had a way of putting his pulse right on his finger right on the pulse of what was happening at that time. So that sort of the common man, he could really do it. And I was just all about me. So it was quite a difference, actually.
But then you stuck with it.
There was a point, I think, where I realized that, and it was kind of late in life. I was living in New Mexico, so it wasn't exactly the hub of music business activity. So I was there for a long time, all through the 70s and 80s and into the 90s even. And there was a certain point when I realized that no magical thing was going to happen for me without my having to go get it and go work for it. And it was quite late in my life. I signed with Red House Records. I started touring in a van. I slept on people's couches. I was probably the oldest couch sleeper opening act in the folk music world. But I had this sort of epiphany with myself. If you don't do this now, you're going to really regret it later that you didn't just throw yourself into this and do it.
And by that time, you had already released records and written a lot of songs.
I had written a lot of songs, and I was very well known around the Southwest. I was a regional folk singer. So But yeah, it was a different thing to take it out. And my first gigs played in the East Coast were, it was 1999, I think.
Which really isn't that long ago.
No, it was really, like I say, kind of late in life. I sustained myself fine living. I was a very back to the land hippie, and I had a cool band. We toured around the Southwest and Texas and stuff, but I had never really hit the road.
Well, pick up that story after you play another song.
All right. Well, speaking of making fun of yourself, I'll do this one.
I wake up in the morning, the dogs are barking, the birds are singing. New day dawning, and I'm so worried about everything. Thank God I'm breathing, and I still got my wedding. Something good. Eliza, little Eliza. Oh, Eliza, little Eliza Jane. This world still got half a chance, still got half a voice that's singing, still doing that doomsday dance. I'm so worried about everything. Swing around the one-way track like you're ringing around.
Eliza Wilkerson singing that one from the Nocturne Diary. So what was the reaction from people when you sang that one the first couple of times?
A lot of people remember that that's an old fiddle tune, Little Eliza Jane. Mm-hmm. So they knew I was kind of going off on that. But I think people are used to me being pretty serious about things, so I think it was probably a relief to hear me have fun and make fun of myself.
At your own expense.
Yes, and laugh at my own expense, exactly.
So not too long ago, I mean 15 years ago, 16 years ago, you said, I'm leaving the Southwest and taking on the world, or at least the rest of the United States and Canada, decided to tour the rest of the country and go national. And it was interesting because I remember seeing you around then, had heard of you, but I'd never seen you. And I kept thinking I had been missing something, you know, not that you hadn't been out and about, but I'd been missing something because here was this fully formed artist.
I get that from so many people. They go, I don't know who you are and how, you know, I've never heard of you before. And you've got all these songs. And people say, you know, gosh, you've got so many songs. And they just, and I'm like, yeah, because I'm old. Like, yeah, I got a lot of songs. I've had a very full life, and I think my songs were really the story of this life of someone from my generation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and there's insight that comes from, you know, from having spent a few years on this planet, and I like sharing that in the songs, but I am sort of a late comer.
But it was such a treat, because a lot of times when you see an artist you've never seen before, or a name that you don't recognize, you know, you get somebody very green. Mm-hmm. And it's a different animal. It's a totally different animal. And I remember being in a room seeing a showcase, and people kept saying, how could I have missed this?
Oh, all that's these so years? Nice. Thank you for saying that. I missed out on a lot too by, you know, staying so close to home. I really found a whole other part of myself, putting myself out there and sort of at this, you know, at the mercy of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You know, it was sort of, it was a great change in my life too. It was a very freeing thing to just take this leap that I had never taken before.
Wish I could do the same today, little darling. Wish I could do the same today. Doe-eyed kid and a little transistor tuned into Wolfman Jack. I picked up a guitar, heard the sirens whisper, and I never looked back, little darling. And I never looked back. The clubs along the Sangre de Cristos, polish the diamond in the rough. By the time I hit LA, I was hotter than a pistol. But you're never hot enough, little darling. You're never really hot enough. I felt the lights on the big, big stages, the fire burning in my soul. I've had those nights when my guitar rages, but it's not something you control, little darling. It's not something you control. Red-tailed diving for a rat on sunset. Trash. Oh, I wish I was lying like a cat in the sun instead of working like a dog for cash. But darling, I'm only working for the cash. Sometimes I wish I could unplug this cord and my soul or my money I could save. Oh, but every time I say I'm gonna quit the beauty way, I hear my bones just turning in their grave. Turning in their grave. Hey, yeah. Hey, yeah. Hey, yeah.
I'm Catherine Cole. More music and conversation with Eliza Gilkison is coming up. You are listening to Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network. Thank you.
again from Washington. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. My guest today is Eliza Gilkison, and earlier she was talking about her father, singer and songwriter Terry Gilkison. Now, what she didn't mention was that her grandmother was also a writer, and the song The Solitary Singer features her words set to music by Eliza's father. She sang this one for us on a visit about 10 years ago. I thought it would be nice to hear it one more time. Eliza Gilkison on Roots and Branches.
Dark comes down like a bird in flight. Most good people have gone to rest. But us poor fools who wake at night when we're lonely, we sing our best. Listening hark out in the dark, a mockingbird in the tall oak tree. Bust his throat on a high sweet note. Nobody knows he's there but me. Sings his best when nobody's listening. Nobody's listening but me. Dark comes down like a heron's wing. Honeysuckle
Solitary singer Eliza Gilkison is visiting in the Roots studio today. Okay, let's get back to your story. You started out on the road to being a touring musician a bit later than some people. You'd already raised a family by then. So when you finally found your way to the clubs and the concert halls, touring nationally, what was the reaction?
I started getting a lot of attention, and I got a Grammy nomination, and I things were just really going well for me. I have to work to sustain it, and but it still feels like it's growing, and I'm never going to be a mainstream something, but I love my genre. I love folk music. I love the network of the mm-hmm. folk scene. I often liken it to the little village that's over the mountain, you know, that it's not really connected to the rest of the world, but it has its own media and its own network of fans and press and promo and stuff, and so it's in radio. So it's its own wonderful scene that's not part of the big industry, and I've actually grown to be quite fond of that and appreciative of that, because it gives me an artistic freedom that I'm very grateful for.
And it's booming all over the world.
It
too.
Is. That's
is really what
true.
Just astounds me.
We all can tour. We're all touring everywhere. I just got back from England. It's a whole network of like-minded people, and it's a wonderful supportive system.
I was in New Zealand a couple of years ago and turned the radio on and heard something that said, sounded familiar, and it was my program. And after I almost drove the car off the wrong side of the road, which was the right side of the road in their country, I had to stop to laugh because that was the last thing I expected.
Yeah, it's so neat that you got to hear that. You got to see the beautiful way that it's like a musical diaspora or something. It just has its own way. It makes its way out through the world, and it's not the mainstream thing that everybody's focused on, but it's very powerful in its own current. You know, it's a wonderful thing.
And I love hearing from all our listeners in Africa, all over the country. Oh, I mean, it's just wonderful. You'll be surprised who you hear from after this.
Well, actually, I should shout out to Beatrice Masika in Uganda because we became fans. She became a fan of mine, and I actually put her through college. But I can only do one per lifetime. But
that's wonderful.
I did put her through university, and she came to me through you.
That's an amazing story. You'll have to write that down and send it to me so I can let the big bosses know about that.
Well, I will.
That's the type of story we love hearing.
Yeah, we became email pals, and after a time, I just realized she was an amazing person, and I wanted to help her. So
lovely!
Yeah. It was a neat story. Yeah, definitely through you guys.
Well, let's have another song, and I hope that she's tuning in today, and we'll have to make sure that she knows about this. I love stories like that.
I should have told you that.
You probably did.
Yeah, maybe so.
But many people have come in and said to me that last time I was here, you know, I heard from somebody and then they drove 6 hours to see me when I was playing.
Yes, and I've also had soldiers from the armed forces also write me, and especially when I was protesting the war in Iraq, and I got so much support from them. We're wondering what's going on too, and we have questions too, and it felt good to be able to exercise the freedom that they are fighting for, you know.
Right.
It was
because that's what it's all about, is freedom.
I know. Well, it's funny because everybody uses that because freedom, you know, like, but it actually is true. And that one of the most important ones is the right to dissent. So I'm switching over to electric here.
How about a love song?
End times love songs. I'm really good at those. Honest.
Turn off the harsh glare of the flat screen blue light. Turn off the hardware. Get it out of my sight. Slip.
just beautiful.
Thank you.
Visiting with Eliza Gilkison today. Now, you may think that Eliza just picked up another guitar, but actually that's the same guitar she was playing before. Tell people about that one.
This is a wonderful, wonderful Gibson-made guitar that I am just mad for. They're really hard to find. It's called a Gibson CF-100E. This is a 51, the first year they made them. A friend of mine, Nick Forster, who runs E-Town, he had one. He said, Liza, you should check out this guitar. And I played it, and within 5 minutes, I knew I had to have one. It took me 6 months to find one. They're really hard to find. I think Gibson only made a few thousand of them. But it has a wonderful old P90 pickup in it here that is a great fat electric sound that sits here. And then I put in a Highlander acoustic guitar pickup under here, under the bridge, and two jacks. Mm-hmm. I just go back and forth, and I run the electric through this thing called a Sans amp, which any good electric guitar player worth his salt would shame me and would never use a Sans amp. But for a folky, running through a Sans amp is acceptable.
Well, it's just terrific looking.
It's a great, it's an easy rig. I've got, it's like carrying two guitars. I am in love with it, and I love both sounds so much, so I've had a lot of fun with it.
Nick is just a terrific player of so many different things.
Yeah, but a great, great, great player. And I actually, he did a tour with me, a little tour around Colorado, and I got to see his guitar collection. He's got a gorgeous collection. So, yeah, he's a great, great guy.
I understand Hot Rise has got a new record coming
they
out.
They do.
So
it made
very exciting. Is it,
yeah, it's almost out.
Yeah. And they're going to do a big world tour,
it's
or at least a U.S. tour.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I can't wait. I've seen them in all their incarnations, including a fundraiser last year in Boulder last fall when I happened to be out for a wedding.
Oh, how
just
neat.
A friend of mine said, can you come out the night before because Hot Rise is playing?
Yes.
And I was like, I'll change my ticket and pay a little extra just to see them. So
yes,
I can't
and the other guys will be traveling with them too, Wendell.
Yes.
We're bad that we don't remember.
Because we're so busy talking about Eliza Gilkison.
That's right. I'll tell Nick that we've sang his praises.
Yes. Eliza's new album, and we're singing your praises, is called The Nocturne Diaries. And what, is this like your sixth for Red House? I'm trying to think. Something like that. Fifth or sixth or seventh or something. Nice.
It's seven or eight. I think there was a live one in there and then Red
That's
Horse.
Right.
So there's probably nine, actually.
Okay. And Red Horse was an interesting side project.
Yes. Two of my best friends in all the world, Lucy Kaplansky and John Gorka. So that was a very fun project that we did for a couple of years. We put out a record and did a lot of touring. But then I think we all got hungry to go back to our, doing our own thing. So we've stopped doing it. But
and how
it was
did
fun.
That come about? Was it
we were just hanging out. We were all best friends. We loved singing together. It was just a kind of one of those, duh, why didn't we think of that before? And it was purely spontaneous thing. And then we thought, let's do a record and let's do some shows together.
But then you have to juggle everyone's schedules. So.
Yeah, and it was really hard to because we all live very far apart, so making a record together was ridiculously difficult. I think that's kind of put us off from making another one because it was really hard.
Is there anybody else you'd like to team up with?
Well, I have been actually doing a tour with Mary Gaucher and Lynn Miles.
That's right. That
was Three
be
Women
so
and the Truth.
Much fun.
That is a really neat show. It's just three women. We just throw down songs. And I've been doing that with Mary and I, and then we in Canada we do it with Lynn Miles, and then here in the States we do it with Gretchen Peters.
Oh, yeah. Boy, that...
Yeah.
I think you should get all four of you together. Just
actually, that's actually true, and we would be laughing our heads off because we really do have fun. It's really fun, and we get each other to do our best stuff. It's very fun.
And I'll come around and sell the merch for you guys.
Okay, that's fine.
And keep track of everything because you four are about four of my favorite people in the world.
Oh, thank you so much. We get along really well, and it's big fun.
And I think between you probably use all the words in the world that exists for your songs.
We probably do. And what's very funny, though, at most of the shows, it turns out that I, who have always thought of myself as being the darkest of the dark, it turns out that I'm the one who has the love songs and a few positive things to say. So, that's a real twist of events when I'm the most upbeat person in this show.
You mentioned starting to play and write in your teens. Were you always a writer? I mean, even before then?
I know I started out with writing songs. I wasn't really writing poetry or anything like that. I just started out, bang, writing songs as soon as I... And I was playing an instrument pretty early, so I think it all sort of came at once.
Yeah. Did you sing before then?
I had this voice came in very early, and I remember even calling my dad into my... I was like, Dad, come check this out. And I sang from, like, where did this come from? It's like this being had inhabited me, this, you know, mature voice. And it just all kind of came at once.
And the rest of the family did, you know, your sisters and brothers?
My sister and I had a little music duo and for a few years. But she went on, actually got into the business side of things. She actually was the first woman senior vice president of Warner Brothers Records. She worked her way up from coffee gopher to senior vice president.
That's so huge.
Yeah, she was, it was amazing. She was there through the real big Warner Brothers heyday. And then my brother Tony is, of course, a great L.A. guitar player. Mm-hmm. He was just on Jimmy Kimmel the other night with Johnny Depp and Chuck E. Weiss. So Tony is a
killer guitar player.
He's killer, yeah. He really is. And then my son now, Cisco, is producing my records.
Well, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah,
it's always a family affair on your records.
I love bringing the family into it. I'm such a great believer in the power of family. And it's a kind of a natural thing to invite them. And really, Delia, my daughter, and my son, Cisco, they're the best singers to go with my voice. There's no one that can sing with me better than they, except for maybe Red Horse.
Right.
But they just match me so well. So I love putting them on my records. They're always on there, and they're just together, this harmony blend is really quite, I think, really neat.
Well, there's always something about family voices. I mean, no matter who the family is,
yes,
you know, you can always just tell.
Yes, I think that's really true, actually. There's something about a blend like that that is unique, yeah.
This record has not been out for very long, but are you already writing? Are you working on the next thing?
I am because I have an idea of something I want to do. So it's kind of a collection of these non-religious hymns that I've written over the years.
Oh.
And I have so many of them some have gone, you know, really done well out in the world. And I'd like to put them all into one collection that's kind of like a hymnal of and that's, I think, my next project. Yeah, it's very not, like I say, it's non-religious, but it's, you know, these songs that come from, I think, a more spiritual place.
So you're somebody that's always looking and thinking and writing.
I am sort of obsessive, you know, and that probably works well when I'm writing. But it can be very annoying otherwise.
Because I was going to say, I talk to people who, when I say that, they look appalled and they say, well, when I'm out on the road, I can't write. It just
no,
doesn't work.
I know. And I found that as I get older, I really do have to be more disciplined because I'm not as knee-jerk, emotionally knee-jerk as I used to be, where I would sort of use writing to work process an emotional thing. And that's not really the case anymore. So I actually do, I'm more intellectual in my approach, but once I get down into the writing, it's much more visceral. It's not, and it becomes non-intellectual. I start to, you know, go down a rabbit hole. But yeah, it's different than when I was younger.
Are there more keepers now? I mean, do you know?
Definitely. I know right pretty quickly if it's working, and I keep 9 out of 10 now. And
wow.
Yeah, I didn't used to at all. I have notebooks full of songs that were better left unsung. But these days, I seem to have honed it down. I've started teaching songwriting at my house in Taos because I feel like I finally have gotten to the point where I'm pretty comfortable with songwriting.
And, you know, you said you have a place in Taos. The rest of the time, you're in Austin when you're not on the road. Mm. What is it about that city that attracts so many musicians and artistic people?
I don't know. I think, for one thing, I mean, there are all kind of woo-woo theories about it, but... The business end of music never really took off in Austin. They tried to make a business thing happen, but it's a great fan base, for one thing. People just love to go out and hear music. It's easygoing, friendly city, so it's just the perfect place to go hear music, and people really turn out for shows. They're rabid fans. And so you can be playing in that town and have a bunch of other shows going on, and still you'll pack out your show. Everybody's going out. It's just a young person's town. It's people like to be out at night. I don't understand it. And I think South by Southwest really kicked it over into a whole other thing. And of course, it had the reputation from Austin City Limits all those years ago of being a kind of outside of the industry, outside the box, renegade kind of vibe there for musicians. And some of my most favorite musicians live there now, and people are more musicians moving there all the time.
And then Taos in New Mexico is the exact opposite.
It is. There's no scene there. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that because I have wonderful musician friends in Taos, but it is not connected. And that's maybe what I love about it, too. It's otherworldly there. That song, Midnight Oil, when I say Moonlight Over the Mountain, that was Taos Mountain that I wrote it about. The beautiful mountain that's the rain catcher and the snow catcher that, you know, that catches the water that feeds that whole village in the Pueblo, Taos Pueblo. And I have so many beautiful friends there, and I love to just get out in nature. And I'm very, very fortunate that I can have that little scene there and do my songwriter classes there. And it's been a wonderful thing that I've been able to manage somehow. So, I can't ever live there year round, because I have to work. But it is really nice to go and renew my soul there.
Well, let's have one more song and then we'll wrap things up.
All right. This is the first song that I wrote for Nocturne Diaries. And I got the Nocturne Diaries is all songs that I wrote in the middle of the night. Every single song was written at night. And nighttime is often the time when... the sort of the dark side of things, mm-hmm. The other side, the other world, the things you don't think about during the day come up. And so this, I woke up in the middle of the night and I was so worried about everything. And just, you know, what's going to happen to my grandchildren in this world, and financially, ecologically, you know, all these things were going through my head. And I was kind of worried. It was more than worried. I couldn't sleep. I was tossing and turning. I was really worried. And I realized I had this beautiful person sleeping next to me and my husband. And I thought, God, you know, how come he just sleeps through the night and it's so great? And I thought, well, I'm just going to reach my foot over there and just touch him, which I did. And it was like, you know, a Valium drip or something. It was like so immediately felt better. And I thought, God, you're my touchstone. And then I thought, Liza, you better get up and write that down because you won't remember tomorrow. So this is you're my touchstone.
When shadows fall, where you lie sleeping in that dark hour before the dawn, your breathing calm, your lone heart beating, give me the strength to carry on. My darling one, you are my touchstone, my guiding light when I'm alone. Your love shines through this world's obstruction. The road to you is my journey home. My heart's been claimed since we came together. The girl I was, I can't recall. Your love has changed me for the better. The way that love can change us all. My darling one, you are my guiding light when I'm alone. Your love shines through this world's obstruction. The road to you is my journey home. Go and one stays behind, then we will know we kept love's promise and wasted not
our precious time. My darling one, you are my touchstone, my guiding light when I'm alone. Your love shines through this world's obstruction. The road to you's my journey.
Touchstone from the Nocturne Diaries, Eliza Gilkison. I would hope that your husband's very proud of being the guy that spawned that song, if nothing else.
He has inspired so much, so he appreciates it, I'm sure. He's shy, but...
He's shy?
Well, no, actually, I mean, he's not shy, but he's private. So it's not that easy being with somebody who writes about you.
But, I guess not.
He is not shy. He's very outgoing, and he's also a speaker and a writer, and he's very politically active. But I think he appreciates it. I know he does.
Where is your touring taking you next?
Well, we have a possibility of Australia in March. We have definitely Ireland in May and Netherlands. Also in May.
Oh, lovely. Well, we'll keep people informed about all that.
Great. Thank you.
And they can find you online.
At ElizaGilkison.com. That is correct.
They can find your tour dates, how to get your CDs,
yes,
pictures,
and
blog,
also information on my songwriting workshops. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, look, don't wait 7 years to come back.
It hasn't been that long. I promise not to.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the program and my visit with Eliza Gilkison. As always, I look forward to your comments. The email address is roots@voa.gov. That is roots@voa.gov. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network.
ევროკავშირი წარმატებული პროექტია.
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2012 to the European Union.
Რასურს საქართველოს ევროპულ სტრუქტურებში ინტეგრაციით.
არი დაუჯო ჩვენი ქვეყნის ევროპულ მოვალს, იმისაც რომ ჩვენი ქვეყანა გახდეს თანამედროვე, ძლიერი ევროპული სახელმწიფო.
ამდა სხვა საკითხებზე ვსაუბრობთ პროგრამა ახალ ევროპაში ყოველ სამშაბათს. გვისმინეთ სიხშირეზე FM 107.4 და სხვა სიხშირეებზე. რადიო